From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's Encore Week on Fresh Air, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. Today we hear from David Bowie and talk about creating his early persona, Ziggy Stardust. This year he had a new CD, and the Ziggy Stardust movie played in many theaters in celebration of its 30th anniversary. Also, we talk about singer Dusty Springfield with her biographer, Vicki Wickham. Springfield's many hits included I Only Want to Be With You and The Look of Love. The biography reveals what few of her fans knew. Springfield was a lesbian and suffered from manic depression. And one of hip-hop's pioneer DJs, Grandmaster Flash, tells us how he developed his turntable techniques. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Richard Lugar, is advising the Bush administration to coordinate with South Korea, Japan, and others on how to deal with North Korea. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The Indiana Republican told NBC's Today Show that it would be, in his words, very inadvisable to launch a military strike on North Korea. Lugar argues the only way to proceed is through multilateral engagement. The Bush administration has already made clear it has no plans to invade North Korea and has been trying to maintain international pressure to force North Korea to suspend its nuclear program. According to a State Department spokesman, the issue came up again when Secretary of State Colin Powell called his Russian counterpart, Igor Ivanov. Over the past week, North Korea has dismantled surveillance equipment and taken steps to restart a reactor at the Yongbyon nuclear complex. The International Atomic Energy Agency says those actions are tantamount to nuclear brinkmanship. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
A construction company owner from West Virginia has won a record jackpot in the Powerball Christmas Day lottery. Jack Whitaker won the $315 million prize, but elected to take a lump sum of about $111 million after taxes. He said his first act will be to donate money to churches.
The very first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go home. I'm going to sit down and make out three checks to three pastors for 10% of this check.
Overall, the 55-year-old contractor said he plans to donate $17 million to the pastors, possibly to establish a Christian school. Whitaker said he plans to spend money on his family and expand his contracting business to bring some laid-off employees back to work. Retail analysts say this has been the worst holiday shopping season in three decades. Stores are hoping that shoppers looking for post-Christmas bargains will help pull them out of a difficult season. Alicia Zuckerman reports from member station WNYC.
Retailers started cutting prices even before Christmas this year, but today marked the beginning of the major sales. Some stores are even using email to remind shoppers to come in and save money. Crain's New York Business Retail reporter, Catherine Curran.
The retailers are offering even deeper discounts than they had before Christmas. We're seeing sales of as much as 75% off. And it's an important time for the stores because they can do as much as 11% of their holiday volume in the week after Christmas.
Critical, but not a sure thing. Curran is doubtful that retailers will be able to make up for the pre-Christmas slump. Consumers, she says, are too worried about the economy and a possible war with Iraq to be in the mood to splurge. For NPR News, I'm Alicia Zuckerman in New York.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 15 points to close at 8,432 in light trading. The Nasdaq lost 4 points to close at 1,367. This is NPR News. A 250,000 people held rallies across Britain today in support of fox hunting. The British government hopes to restrict the sport. Traditionally, the day after Christmas is Britain's biggest fox hunting day. NPR's Guy Raz reports from London.
Hunters across Britain mounted horses and corralled packs of dogs as they went tearing off into the countryside in pursuit of foxes. Ian McKee, a member of the pro-hunting Countryside Alliance, turned out for a rally in Winslow, northwest of London.
Countryside sports will go forward, come what may. There will possibly be a rethink over the various ruling bodies of fox hunting, but fox hunting will go ahead.
In the past, the government here has tried to abolish hunting, but has met fierce opposition from rural constituents. Prime Minister Tony Blair's Labour government has introduced a measure that would ban certain types of hunting, but would preserve fox hunting under license in certain circumstances. The bill, though, has stalled in Britain's upper chamber, the House of Lords. polls here show a majority of Britons support restrictions on hunting. Guy Raz, NPR News, London.
UN weapons inspectors visited an Iraqi technical university today, touring labs and talking with top officials. An Iraqi general said Iraq will soon give the inspectors a list of scientists who've worked on nuclear, chemical, biological, and missile programs. General Hossam Mohammed Amin also said that the UN experts have found no evidence of weapons of mass destruction in their inspections so far. The UN inspectors had no comment on that statement. Chief Inspector Hans Blix is expected to report to the UN Security Council on the findings of the inspections on January 27th. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Encore Week on our show, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. Some critics consider Dusty Springfield the best British female rock singer of the 60s. She had many hits in England and America, including Wishin' and Hopin', I Only Want to Be With You, I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, The Look of Love, and The Son of a Preacher Man. Springfield died of cancer in 1999, just before her 60th birthday. A recent authorized biography called Dancing with Demons describes the aspects of her personal life that few of her fans knew about, including that she was a lesbian. The author, Vicky Wickham, was Springfield's longtime friend and manager. She produced the British TV music program Ready, Steady, Go, which Springfield appeared on and later co-hosted. And Wickham co-wrote one of Springfield's hits, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Here's an excerpt of the interview with Wickham, which we first broadcast last January. Dusty Springfield really had a look in the 60s when she became a star. Why don't you describe the kind of fashion she wore, how she did her eyes, her hairdos?
Dusty had this huge bouffant hairdo, which required a lot of backcombing and a lot of spray, which we would sometimes laugh and say that she was responsible alone for the ozone layer. She also wore a lot of makeup. She looked at the fashion magazines and the film magazines of the time and would look at people like Monica Vitti, I suppose like a Bardo, that type of thing, and she followed their eye makeup, which was a lot of black, like a panda makeup with a lot of heavy eyeliner above the lid as well as below. And dress-wise, she was what in those days was called a mod. You had mods and rockers, and Dusty was a mod with short skirts and skimpy little tops. I mean, she was very fashionable. You know, kids would emulate her.
You actually co-wrote one of Dusty Springfield's songs, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which was released in 1966. How did you come to co-write the song, and tell us if there's a story behind it?
Well, there is. Dusty had been at the San Remo Song Festival and came back with an Italian song that each time she was going to record, she'd say, I must write lyrics to it. She never did, so she never recorded it. And it came to the time in 64 where she said, I really need to record this song. And I, like a big mouth, said, well, any fool can write lyrics. So she said, well, okay, if any fool can write lyrics, go and write lyrics. And luckily, I was having dinner that night with a friend of mine, Simon Napier-Bell, who was a musician. And I said to Simon, before we go to dinner, we have to do these lyrics for Dusty because she's recording tomorrow. Really, in about 30 minutes, we'd got the basis of it and then finished it off in the taxi. And the next day, when I was typing them up for Dusty, I called Simon and I said, these are horrible. I cannot give these to Dusty. And he said, well, what are you going to do? So I said, I suppose give them to Dusty because there's no choice. Like, so I think I sent them through or sent them over to Dusty or dropped them off or something. And she said, these are really bad. And I said, I know, we know that. Anyway, she recorded it. And of course, it went to number one.
Why did you think they were so bad, the lyrics?
They're really inane. And if you look at the lyrics, I think the word left is in there about six times. Although, you know, when you become familiar with them, you think, okay, they're not perhaps not so bad.
So, well, why don't we hear the song and we'll let everybody judge what they think of the
okay.
lyrics. It certainly did well for her and for you.
You don't have to say seems dead and so unreal. All that's left is loneliness. There's nothing left to feel. You don't have to say
that's You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, a 1966 hit by Dusty Springfield. My guest Vicki Wickham co-wrote the lyrics. She also co-wrote Dusty Springfield's new biography called Dancing with Demons. Now, as you were getting to know Dusty Springfield, something that you learned about her was that she was a lesbian, and this was at a time when virtually no performers were really out of the closet, certainly not in pop music. How did you find out about that?
Well, because we were friends, so we were hanging out together. We, you know, had some of the same friends. We were beginning to have our own friends. And, you know, obviously, you know, you know what your friends are doing.
And are you gay too?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you have to keep each other's secrets? Did it need to be as big a secret for you as it was for her? Because you weren't a performer and could maybe afford to be a little more open.
Well, exactly. For me, it was never a problem because I wasn't in the public eye, and I was always openly gay, and it was absolutely fine. But for somebody like Dusty, it did matter. I mean, it was absolutely unheard of in 63, in the early 60s, and I really do think it would have harmed her at the time had people really known. You have to remember, too, the press in England, it's got worse over the years, but they're very intrusive. I mean, there are a lot of tabloids. As you know, we have about 6 or 7 daily papers and then all the Sunday papers. So they need something to write about, and the more sensational it is, the better. The bigger name you are, obviously, the bigger story. And it was a real worry that, you know, the papers would start splashing it across.
In the new authorized biography of Dusty Springfield, you write about her depressions. You say she was diagnosed as manic depressive, and her depressions were sometimes very severe. What was she like on either end of her mood swings?
She could go into the blackest moods ever and very irrational in terms of nothing was right, nothing was good enough, including herself. Just really deep depressions, which would last sometimes for minutes, and it usually resulted in damaging some innate object of some sort. Never a danger to anybody else or at that point herself. And then on the other end, you know, when she'd come out of them, she was the most intelligent, wonderful, funny, interesting, up person imaginable. I mean, it's hard when she was her normal self, it was hard to imagine that she could possibly be any other way.
She also mutilated herself. She cut on her arms and legs. I think much more is known about that kind of self-mutilation now than was known then. It seems either more common or at least more publicly discussed. How did she and her doctors deal with it? And I don't know whether this was mostly in the 1960s or 70s.
It was both. At the time, you're right, I mean, not that much was known about it. And the biggest thing that I think was a mistake, and I mean, she felt the same way, she never found any help for it, meaning a shrink, a therapist. You know, the British are very anti that type of thing, especially in the 60s and 70s. I mean, we all felt that a good cup of tea would solve everything rather than going to talk to somebody. And of course, now we know better that, you know, it does help to have some professional advice and professional help. At the time, nobody was doing that. So it became an occurrence which would happen far too frequently. And, you know, like with anything like that, it's a cry for help and nobody was helping.
Would the depression go away when she was on stage?
It's interesting you should say that. Absolutely. Dusty, as much as she hated getting on stage, was scared stiff about it, once she got on stage, was A, the true professional, was absolutely wonderful, and thoroughly enjoyed herself.
You were at her funeral when she died?
Yes.
What What was the funeral like, and was there any of her music that was played there?
Yes, I put it together with Simon Bell, the two of us, and I just said to Simon, you know, Dust was such a star, an artist. We have to just have a very grand funeral. And as you know, the body was put in an open horse-drawn carriage, which has stopped the traffic in Henley. And yes, it was all her music. We played Going Back, which is very apt, a Goffin and King song. And the coffin actually went out to You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And as it came out of the church, the crowd outside, I'm only laughing because she would have loved it, broke into applause. And Elton said, it's the only funeral I've ever heard of that the coffin gets the applause. She would have definitely been chuffed and had a giggle.
It must have been odd for you to produce her funeral after having worked with her for so many years.
It was bizarre, but it kind of completed the cycle for me. I mean, in a way, I just didn't believe that she was dead. And by doing the funeral and going through that, it actually closed the book, which was wonderful.
Vicki Wickham's biography of Dusty Springfield is called Dancing with Demons. Our interview was first broadcast last January.
The look of love is in your eyes. The look your heart can't disguise. The look saying so much more than just words can ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited just to love you. Now that I have found you, you've got the look of love. This song, your face, a look, the time can erase. Be mine. Just the start of so many nights like this. Let's take a lover's vow and then seal it with a kiss. I can hardly wait to hold, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited just to love you. Now that
coming up, Encore Week continues with David Bowie. This is Fresh Air. It's Encore Week on Fresh Air, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. David Bowie released a new CD this year called Heathen. Over the summer, in celebration of the 30th anniversary of his glam rock classic, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, an expanded version of the Ziggy album was reissued on CD, and the film played in theaters. Ziggy was one of Bowie's early gender-bending alter egos, mixing androgyny and science fiction. He wore elaborate eye makeup and lipstick and dyed his hair bright red. Even before Ziggy, Bowie posed on the cover of his 1970 album, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a gown and makeup. In his early career, each album seemed to find Bowie in a different persona, with a new sound to match his new look. That character-driven part of his career ended years ago, but he still inhabited different characters in his movie roles. I spoke with Bowie last summer. We started with a song from Heathen called Afraid.
I wish I was smarter. I got so lost on the shore.
Have an alter ego to go with this particular CD?
Nope.
Is having an alter ego less important to you than it used to be?
I think much has been made of this alter ego business. I mean, I actually stopped creating characters in 1975 for albums anyway. The only time that I've adopted characterization again since that point for my own albums has been an album called Outside that I did with Brian Eno a few years ago, which really had a myriad, maybe one too many characters, but had a lot of characters on that, and I played all the parts. But that was done as a sonic, theatrical piece of music. But the character thing really is sort of, for me personally, rather ancient history. But it's kind of, I guess over here specifically in America, the soundbitey thing really kind of stays around, and you're known by the, you're defined by the two or three things that the largest amount of people know about, and that kind of is who you are publicly. And mine is really Ziggy Stardust, characters, Let's Dance. That's me in the American, frankly, in the American eye. But in fact, in Europe, I'm more kind of this bloke what writes lots of stuff and I kind of I guess I, you know, a greater number of the 26 or so albums that I've made are known in Europe than they are in America.
How is your sense of yourself as a performer different now at the age of 55 than it was when you were in your 20s and getting started and being when you were in persona and doing the whole, you know, eye makeup and dyed hair and dresses,
yeah,
when you were
That was for 18 months, actually.
Right.
Which, out of a career of nearly 40 years, is not very long. However, yeah. I'll answer your question. I'm not actually a very keen performer. I like putting shows together. I like putting events together. In fact, everything I do is about the conceptualizing and realization of a piece of work, whether it's the recording or the performance side. And kind of when I put the thing together, I don't mind doing it for a few weeks, but then, quite frankly, I get incredibly bored because I don't see myself so much as a performer. I mean, I don't live for the stage. I don't live for an audience.
Can I stop you and say that I'm really surprised to hear that?
Most people are.
Yeah, because I always thought of you as somebody who really relished the theater aspect of performance and who very successfully made theater a part of music performance.
Frankly, if I could get away with not having to perform, I'd be very happy. It's not my favorite thing to do. I don't mind trying it out and making sure something seems to work well, but I really do rather want to move on, because I think it's rather a waste of time endlessly singing the same songs every night for a year. And it's just not what I want to do. What I like doing is writing and recording and much more on the, on that creative level. It's fun interpreting songs and all that, but I wouldn't like it as a living.
No, before you became David Bowie, when you were, I mean, when you were working, when you were playing with other bands before forming your own, did you do the denim thing? You know, did you wear a T-shirt and jeans on stage?
Very, very rarely, actually. No, it wasn't really something that I... Because I never believed it. It always felt like you were trying too hard to look like the audience or something. That whole thing about the artistic integrity, which, of course, I've never bought into with any artist. It's just not a real thing.
Wait, so let me stop you and see if I got this straight. Wearing a T-shirt and jeans seemed phony to you, but wearing mascara and eye makeup seemed right.
I didn't say that wearing a glamorization of the rock artist was any truer.
Oh, okay, right. It's artifice, but it's an artifice.
It's all artifice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think my main point would be is that the T-shirt and denims thing, in my mind, was also an artifice.
Right.
I didn't feel comfortable in that because I didn't feel like one of the working men. I mean, I could never be a blue-collar-y kind of Springsteen-y type artist because I don't believe I am that. And I don't believe I could ever represent that. And it is merely representation.
Well, getting back to Ziggy, the story of Ziggy Stardust is a story of someone who becomes very famous. It's the story of rock and roll fame. Becomes very famous, and then fame becomes his downfall. He's kind of killed in a way by fame. What did that fable that you created mean to you at the time? Is that the way you saw rock and
roll?
Well,
I can only really look at it the way I look at it now, which is, I think, independently of myself, Ziggy Stardust has his own life. He's his own creation, and you know what? Good luck to him. But frankly, for me, I kind of closed the door on him in 1973, and I'm very happy that he's having such success and that people still like him and all that. I heard he got married. Anyway, I personally have another life, which doesn't belong to Ziggy Stardust, and I do tend to not really get that involved in what I've done in the past. I do kind of leave that up to other people, and that's much how I feel about Ziggy. I kind of prefer the audience and maybe writers or commentators or whatever, to make what they will of the Ziggy Stardust period and character, because it actually doesn't interest me much now.
David Bowie recorded last summer. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show as our encore week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers. Find lawyers, find law. FINDLAW.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Adventures on the Wheels of Steel. We talk with hip-hop pioneer Grandmaster Flash about developing his scratching and mixing turntable techniques. And we continue our conversation with David Bowie. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Encore Week on Fresh Air, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. Let's get back to the interview with David Bowie, which we first broadcast last September. Here's Bowie's 1971 hit Changes. As rock critic Ken Tucker wrote in the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, In the face of the hippie era's sincerity, intimacy, and generosity, Bowie presented irony, distance, and self-absorption. His song Changes announced the arrival of a new counterculture.
Waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
There's gonna have to be a different man.
Did you grow up thinking of yourself as a singer, or did you start singing because you wanted to sing, you know, because you wanted to perform?
No, what I wanted to do when I was 9 years old, I wanted to be the baritone sax player in the Little Richard Band. I probably also wanted to be black at that particular time as well. So I got my father to help me out with a saxophone and we bought it over like a 2-year period. We had something in Britain then called the hire purchase system, or HP, and I bought it on HP, which is like you pay 2 and 6 pence a week.
Oh, buying it on time.
Yeah, over like 1,000 years. So in the end, it cost you maybe twice as much as if you could have afforded cash.
Right.
And I started playing around with local rock bands, you know, with the alto. And then, in a nutshell, somebody fell ill one night, the lead singer in one of the bands, and they knew I could sing, so they asked me if I would stand up. And I quite enjoyed it, actually, I must say, at 14. It was a real trip, you know, to have girls wave at you and smile and everything just because you opened your mouth and sang. I really wanted to do more than anything else up until I was around 16, 17, was write musicals.
Was write music.
Musicals.
Oh, musicals.
I really wanted to write musicals. That's what I wanted to do more than anything else. Because I like rock music, I kind of moved into that sphere, somehow thinking that somewhere along the line I'd be able to put the two together. And I suppose I very nearly did with the Ziggy character, but I had such short attention span and got disinterested so quickly after I'd created some kind of project that I wanted to move on, and I never really got the book together for the thing. So I had all the songs and the characters. But by the time we'd gotten it on the road and I'd been doing it for 18 months, oh, God, I couldn't wait to move on to something else.
So when you say you wanted to write musicals, did you want to write, like, Rodgers and Hart kind of musicals or Hair? I mean, what...
No, that was my point. No, yeah. My point was I wanted to rewrite how rock music was perceived.
Oh, I see.
And I thought
right.
that I could do some kind of vehicle involving rock musicals
right.
and presenting rock and characters and storyline in a completely different fashion.
So was singing something you started doing to come so that you could do that kind of theater?
It was it was the conception that, I mean, God, I would love to have handed it on to somebody else, and I guess Ziggy would have been the perfect vehicle to have done with. I don't know why, to this day, I didn't find some other kid after I'd done it for like 6 months and said, here, I'll put the wig on and send him out and do the gigs, you know. I mean, it would have been much the best thing to do, and then I could have moved on quicker to something else. But that comes back to what I was saying. I needed to sing because nobody else was singing my songs.
Right.
So I had to do it myself.
You were briefly in a mime group before...
Yes, the Lindsay Kemp Mime Company.
Yeah, before becoming a solo musician.
Yeah. Well, actually, it all kind of ran... I tended to be... I seem to be kind of involved in so many things all at the same time, which is still how I kind of operate today. I can't keep my fingers out of any pies.
Well, are there things that you learned or became aware of through that mime group that you said, yeah, that I really like that, I'm going to work with that in my own performances?
I think everything that I learned about stagecraft and carrying through, creating a through point for a theatrical device. I think Lindsay Kemp really introduced me to the work of Jean Genet, and through that, I kind of kept re-educating myself about other prose writers and poets. Mm-hmm. He opened an awful lot of doors for me in terms of a new approach to what I could do. I could never have done what I did without being involved with Lindsay Kemp's company.
While we're on the subject of mime, I have to mention that in the Ziggy movie, you do those hands walking across the glass wall thing.
I know. That's my proudest moment of the Ziggy Stardust movie.
The dreaded mime thing.
Yeah. Well, meme over here, isn't it? I know. It's so utterly abhorred over here. We didn't know that in England because we love it over there. And it broke our hearts when we came over here and realized that memes were kind of tantamount to some kind of artistic criminals.
David Bowie, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Bowie recorded last summer after the release of his CD, Heathen. Coming up, Encore Week continues with Grandmaster Flash. This is Fresh Air. It's Encore Week on Fresh Air, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002.
We're Grandmaster Flash. We're giving you a blast of class.
Last July, I spoke with Grandmaster Flash, one of the pioneer hip-hop DJs. In the 70s, he developed mixing and scratching techniques that became part of the basics of hip-hop. He started off DJing records at parties in the South Bronx. His group, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, were one of the first hip-hop groups to break out of the local scene and become an international success. Here's their classic 1982 recording, The Message.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out.
Grandmaster Flash, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
I'm interested in how you started mixing music, how you started using two turntables or maybe even more than two. Was this something you started doing at home or in clubs as a DJ?
My love for vinyl and for the turntables probably came about when I was old enough to sort of start looking into turntables and stuff of that nature. And that's probably, although it was a negative experience, and when I say negative, meaning like I used to just sort of take apart electrical items in my mother's house, including turntables, just to figure out how they work and why they work. And my intention was to put it back together properly, but I just could not do it. But I just had this thing where I just had to know how the inside of a turntable worked, how the inside of a radio worked, and how my father's stereo. And that's probably where it started, just like I had this undying interest.
Well, you basically started using turntables as if they were instruments. How did you start using turntables to change the music that you were listening to as opposed to just playing the music?
Well, I think coming up, I watched a lot of DJs in my early teens, and they would play the music, and I just sort of felt like I can take the most exciting part of a record, which we call the break, and sort of extend that, because a lot of these songs that I was listening to were like obscure funk tunes where the break section was like maybe 10 seconds long. And from a frustrated point of view, I had this thought that if I can just come up with a way of just taking duplicate copies of the record with two turntables and a mixer, I can extend that five or 10 second part seamlessly and make it 10 minutes if I wanted to. And that's, you know, my thoughts manifested into creating an art form called the quick mix theory, which is actually taking a passage of music or two duplicate copies of vinyl and sort of moving the disc back and forth and repeating a section of the passage, you know, between duplicate copies of the record. That's where it started.
So you'd let like the 10 seconds play on one record and then switch to the other turntable, and meanwhile back up the first turntable to the beginning of that part of the record.
Exactly. And that was called the clock theory, yeah.
Because you were putting the needle down on exactly the right part of the record with the rhythm that you wanted to hear, could you actually, you know, some people say that you were able to look at the grooves of a vinyl record and know exactly where the rhythm was that you wanted, that you could actually see it in the grooves.
Well, actually, you know, I was pretty decent at it, but it was my first student that I taught this quick mix theory to, Graham Wizard Theodore, was probably the best at that, and it was called needle drops. But what I came up with is what I call the clock theory, and the clock theory was where you would place the needles down on both copies of the vinyl, and when the ending of one was over, you would push in the next fader, but while the other one was playing, you would sort of spin the record back one or two revolutions to the top of that break, and then when the other one was over, you would push in the other, so it was like push, spin back, push, spin back. So I actually never, you know, this made it an assured way of being able to get back to the beginning of the break section without actually having to pull the needle up. And what I would do is I would mark, like on the label, if it was like a record from if it was a 12-inch from Atlantic Records, and if the break began at, let's just say, at the top of the A, I would sort of put like a magic marker right there. So that would be my clock of where I had to bring the record back to one or two revolutions back to re-arrive at the top of the break. And I would just sort of do this with two copies of records back and forth. So picking up the needle, you know, was no longer an issue. And creating the clock theory, which all DJs use today now, where they mark the album at a certain point, is one of my contributions to the art of the DJ mix.
It was scratching something that you invented, or was that invented by one of the people who influenced you?
Well, actually, it was called cutting because it was actually taking a section of the rhythm and rearranging it. And this is something that I've created over 27 years ago. It's now called scratching, which is sort of just like one part. It's almost like, you know, saying to a boxer, he's boxing, but now we're going to call it right hook. You know, the right hook is only one area of a boxer's skill. And like the scratching is just one area of what this thing, you know, entails, you know.
Scratching, just for any of our listeners who don't know what scratching is when you're moving the record back and forth with the needle on it, and the sound of the needle scratching the record creates part of the rhythm track that you're going
right
for.
Right, because of sort of sound.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So did you practice that a lot at home so you could just, like, really play these turntables as instruments and do exactly what you wanted on them?
Yeah, I sort of, I was looking for something because at this time, when I wanted to come up with this science, there was no point of reference, no blueprints around. So I was probably was more frustrated than anything because, I mean, so much stuff I had to buy. Like, a lot of it was trial and error, you know. Trying to get my hands on the right needle. You know, I had to go through countless needles, you know, trying to find the right turntable. I had to go through countless turntables and then finding the right mixer and then finding the right mixer, but then it didn't have a system where I can pre-hear the music in my head, so I had to create something called the peekaboo system. So I had to, like, actually jury-rig these things, you know, in my frustration. My frustration kept me more... It fueled the fire to me just staying at this and, you know, throwing away my teenage years, you know, where, you know, your teenage years is when, you know, you're feeling your oats and you want to go hang out with the girls and you want to go to the parties and stuff. I think I probably lived either, like, in the junkyards going through, like, abandoned stereo equipment or, going through... abandoned cars, taking out the speakers and the radios and stuff of that nature. I probably lived in my room more so, you know, just looking for something. But at this point in time, I still didn't know what these internal parts was. So while I was tearing up all the stuff inside my mother's house and became, like, public enemy number one with my sisters and stuff, my mother decided to send me to school.
What kind of school?
Samuel Gompers Vocational and Technical High School. And that's where I started to understand, like, what is a resistor, what is a capacitor, what is AC versus DC, what is a transformer, what's a push-pull circuit, what's a diode rectifier, what's an oscilloscope, and what's a wave. And, you know, I started, like, actually understanding as I was, you know, not so now when I tore into something, I sort of had somewhat of an idea of what it is and what it did. So all these things helped me to jury-rig and put together, you know, this peekaboo system to a mixer that didn't have it, and to figure out, you know, how turntables work and how that works. So it kind of helped me to put together the system so that I can start on getting this concept out of my head that just kept staying in my head, so to speak.
Why don't we listen to one of your now classic recordings, and this is The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel.
You see, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Bad Bob Freddy told me everybody slide. DJ spinning, I said, my. Flash is fast. Flash is cool, Francois, c'est pas. Flash ain't no dude.
You see, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
That's Grandmaster Flash from the early 80s, one of his classic recordings, The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to hear that again, but this time keep your microphone on and have you describe what you're doing as we listen to it. Here we go.
You see.
Punch face.
You see.
Spoon and G Monster Jam. I let it go there.
Time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
It's a Blondie here. Punch face. Punch face. Back to Spoonie again.
Time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Into Good Times, Chic. Into Apache on a rub. Cutting it up. Back in again. Punch face, Queen, another one bites the dust. In. Cutting into rhythm. I'm using Good Times to rub the rhythm against Queen. Good Times by Chic.
That release is so nice, the way it synchronizes there.
Thank you. That's the whole key to it, you know. That's what my contribution is, keeping it on time. That was, like, the key.
Grandmaster, come faster.
It's I punch face from Freedom.
Grandmaster, come
cutting it up. I'm punch facing good times. Back to good times.
That's Grandmaster Flash walking us through his recording, The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, recorded in 1981. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Grandmaster Flash, one of the pioneer hip-hop DJs. Now, when we left off in your development as a DJ, you were still working at home and scavenging audio equipment from junked cars and things like that. Once you perfected your technique and you started working parties and then working in clubs, what was it like for you to see the reaction of the crowds to the thing that you had been doing alone in your home?
I think the first time that I decided that I would show this to the public, it was a outdoor dance, a block party, we called it. You can come into the park for free and just, you know, come party. And I think the first time that I showed this, I said to myself, my theory was, if I play the climatic part of duplicate copies of a record, so it'd be like maybe 10 to 15 duplicates, back to back, seamlessly, on time, you know, I should have the neighborhood park in an uproar, when I got the exact opposite. And it's kind of painful that, you know, it didn't work according to what I thought it would. People just sort of just stood there. And it turned out that the real fact of the matter is this vocal entertainment was sort of needed to accompany this new way of DJing. And I made the first attempt, and I was totally horrible of trying to like rap with my mixing, and it was really too much to do at one time because
sure.
it's constantly, you know, it's a constant, you know, taking records on, taking them off, putting them on, you know. So I was horrible at it, and then what I would do is basically put a microphone out on the other side of the table, and anyone that thought that they can verbalize to this newfound science of mixing, please feel free. You know, everybody failed except for this one person who probably was like the savior of my esteem. It was Keith Wiggins. He was my first MC. He went by the name of Cowboy, and Cowboy had a way of he reminded me of like a ringmaster at the circus, you know. And he had a very commanding voice, and he came up with a verbalization, like, you know, throw your hands in the air, say this, ho, say party, and this and that. So that was the perfect diversionary tactic to get people off of looking at me and to look at him and do what he says do while I go through a series of breaks, you know, just playing one behind another seamlessly to the beat.
Let's get to your new CD, the Grandmaster Flash Essential Mix Classic Edition. One of the things on here is Blondie's Rapture, and that's one of the songs that you sample in The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, because she mentions you in the song.
Yes.
How did you find out about each other? Do you know?
Well, actually, how it happened was when I was maybe 10 years before I recorded making records, there was a gentleman by the name of Fab Five Freddy who used to come to my parties, but he also had this incredible connection with, like, the whites and different races of people downtown in the village. So back in the days, he was like hanging downtown in the village, but he would come up to the Bronx and party with Flash, Herc, and Bam. And he was sort of like our town crier also. He would go downtown and say, listen, there's this guy uptown, you guys, you know, this guy named Flash, you got to come, you know, come check him, you know. And he would say to me, I'm going to bring one of my good friends up, Deborah Harry. And everybody at that time knew that name. And I was basically on some yeah, right, whatever. And then surprisingly enough, a couple of weeks later, he brought this woman to my party. And she watched me play, and she was extremely happy with the way that I played. And said that she was going to write a song about me. I took it as a grain of salt. Didn't really believe it until maybe 2 or 3 months later. And she did it. And she opened up so many doors for hip-hop by doing that.
Well, why don't we close with Rapture, which is on your new mix CD. And Grandmaster Flash, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Grandmaster Flash recorded last summer. Our Encore Week, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002, continues through New Year's Day, when we'll feature interviews with Barry Manilow and Tom Waits. You can hear my infamous encounter with Gene Simmons of Kiss on Monday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Peace.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our Encore Week with bluegrass pioneer Ralph Stanley. He recently reached new audiences through the success of the film soundtrack Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And we talk with Muddy Waters biographer Robert Gordon. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
They call me Muddy Water. I'm just restless, man, as the deep blue sea.